someone's paying you, they already have that expectation that you're going to deliver. Gone are the times where you're just shooting for a friend, give them the pictures. Hey, sorry, I accidentally formatted the card. That's not an option anymore. So this is where things get interesting. When you're getting paid, you have an expectation to deliver.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Canon Conversations, the show where I sit down with some of the top creatives in the industry so that you can become a better photographer. On today's show, we're continuing our three-part portrait photography series with Anupam Singh. Anupam, thanks for joining me.
Thanks again, Ben. Thanks for having me. Good to be back on this part two of this conversation that we're having. Thank you.
Fantastic, man. And so, today's show, we're going to be ramping up the difficulty level to intermediate. And this show is for basically the aspiring professional. So we're going to be going through all the kind of tips and techniques one would need to do their first paid portrait gig, or someone who is potentially looking to do a styled shoot for their portfolio. So someone who knows their way around their camera, they've got the fundamentals of, you know, taking a nice photo under their belt, and they're looking to take those techniques and start to build their career. So that's what today's show is all about. And to start us off, Anu, kind of before we pick up the camera. So,
yeah.
We've either got a brief from a client or a brief that we've written ourselves for the kinds of photos we want to be taking. Where do you start in the planning process for that?
Well, congratulations on getting your first job.
Yeah.
Now this is where things get interesting. When someone's paying you, they already have that expectation that you're going to deliver, and you need to set up yourself to deliver that. So. Gone are the times where you're just shooting for a friend, give them the pictures. Hey, sorry, I accidentally formatted the card. That's not an option anymore. So this is where things get interesting. When you're getting paid, you have an expectation to deliver. So you get an email. I want a few photos done for my new brand that I'm starting. I'm going to be selling secondhand clothes, for example. I'm going to have a Shopify website. I'm going to have an Instagram account. I need some photos. That's your email. Where do you start? How do you price this? So you need to ask as many questions as possible to get a picture. So ask them how many shots are we looking at shooting? How much time do you have for this? Say they come back with saying 20 outfits. That's a whole day's job, because you're going to be putting that on the model, styling it. Is it a style shoot or is it just plain white web campaign shots? Get as much as information as possible, and that's going to help you understand what you need to deliver. Just don't go based on what the client says, because they know the business side of things. They don't know how photography works. So my first step would be ask as many questions as possible. Then it comes to mood board. So what does the customer want? How, when they say, I want it on a beach to them could mean something completely different to what it means to you. Whether they want it on sunrise, sunset, what do they have in mind? What I find really useful is to ask for example photos. Because if I say we're going to be shooting on the beach on the left-hand side, doesn't mean anything. Could be, which side are you looking at it from? Ask for a picture, and that always puts everyone on the team on the same page. And that's really important. So set up a mood board, and whatever you're going to deliver, the next part is whatever you're going to deliver, put it down in an email and say, we're going to get 20 outfits. We're going to shoot from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. This is what we're going to get. This is the resolution you've asked me for. You want portrait photos, send it in an email. So that sets the expectation on what the client wants and what you're going to be delivering. Always get that in an email. That's the other tip I would say. And then just start preparing your gear, basically.
Yeah. And so when you're putting your mood board together, roughly sort of how many images and what sort of things are you putting on that mood board for the, and is that for the client? Is it for you? Is it for both?
It's usually the client who gives you the mood board on what they are after. So that gives you an explanation of exactly what they're after, what kind of light they want, what kind of crop they're looking for, and sets the mood for the whole shoot from there. So that's usually a client would give you that. You can sit down with the client and brainstorm and prepare a mood board together, depending on what creative inputs you have and what inputs the client has. So it could be a two-part process, or just most often it's sent to you and this is what they're after.
Yeah, but you definitely want a mood board so that both you and the client are on the same page about the kinds of images you'll be capturing.
The makeup artist, the stylist, they all are on the same page. Things could mean differently to different people coming from different cultural backgrounds, different levels in the industry where they are from. So always put a mood board together. That just sets the whole tone and the expectation for the whole team.
Cool. Fantastic. Okay. Well, before we start touching our gear yet, I guess there's one other aspect around planning I kind of want to go into, and that's location scouting. And this is kind of sort of referencing what we talked about last week in terms of when you're out, you know, take a few photos on your phone, save those cool locations for later. But sort of how do you go beyond that in regards to like hunting out really great locations?
When you have a client and a team on board, you need to see how accessible the location is. Mm. You don't want to be hiking for 3 hours or 4 hours and then get into that location to get a few photos. That's, you're paying for someone's time. The makeup artist, the stylist, the model, you're going to pay for everyone. So depending on how much you need the shot, the location plays a great part in that. So make sure it's accessible to the whole team. Phone signals, stuff like that. Where's the closest toilets again? How good is the parking there? So keep those things into consideration, because it's not just you anymore. It's a whole team that you're taking with you. And you're basically playing host. Like, all these people have come to your house, so you kind of want to make sure they're all comfortable, because it's you. Mm. It's a day where you're going to take photos and the photographer is doing the job. So make sure you're playing host and you know the area well. So that would be the other thing.
Yeah. And I guess what you mentioned last week, which is probably more is good for people to hear today, is the idea of permits. So if you're shooting in a public space, you need, you know, permits and permission from council. And is that usually paid?
Is that depending cost? On what how big the scope of the project is and how long you're going to be using it for. It all depends on that. There's a really good page on the Auckland Council website for photography permits. And these, again, vary. Say you're shooting in a national park, that's a different permit altogether. So keep an eye. Auckland Council has a really good resource. And you usually get it in less than a week. So when you apply for it, they're usually all for it. Depending if you're not going to be blocking traffic and stuff like that, it could go quicker than that.
Cool. Fantastic. Awesome. Okay. So we've got our mood board and our location. We kind of know what the shoot's going to look like, basically. Let's start to talk about gear, and actually sort of on the tail end of gear, we'll start to talk about the crew as well. So your makeup artists and stuff. But let's start with gear. And we're talking beyond cameras and lenses and even flashes now. Like, what's the kind of the full gear breakdown that you make sure you bring on every shoot, and some of those little nitty-gritty bits of kit that you've found over the years that you can't do without?
So I try and carry two bodies.
Mm-hmm.
For quite a few shoots, I couldn't afford a second body, so I used to rent it, borrow it off a friend. Make sure you have two bodies. Worst case scenario, something goes wrong, you're not stopping the whole shoot and you're not wasting someone else's time just because you can't find a setting and the camera is not working the way it's meant to be working. Always have a body. Can't afford it, borrow it off a friend, rent it. Rental is so cheap now. Topic Rentals, Pro Gear, any of the basically camera shops in Auckland, do that. If you're outside of Auckland, get it shipped. They don't charge you for the days it's in shipping. You only pay for the day that you have it. So I don't think it's an option just having one camera and it fails on the day. Camera hasn't failed on me. They're so reliable these days. But it's just to put you at ease, you have a backup. So I usually try and carry two bodies, a couple of lenses. I have a 24 to 70, 7200, 2.8, 50, 135, and 100 mil. So don't need all those lenses. You could start off with just a 50 or a 24 to 70, whatever you have at the time. But try and have a backup, just because it's not your time, it's everybody else's time on the line as well. So, and because the customer is paying you, they have that expectation that you're going to turn up and get the job done. So I try and have two bodies for that.
Definitely. And are you using both those bodies while you are shooting, as in like having different lenses on each one, or is it purely a backup?
I tend to have a 50. That's my favorite focal length. I usually have a 50 on there, and a 24 to 70 just to get that wide shot. It's always with me. Just when I think a wider shot would look nice, I just bring on the 24 to 70 and get a quick shot there as well.
Yeah, but the two bodies is great for that speed. So you're not sort of breaking the flow with
it is, the subject. Because once you get into that flow, it takes a while to get back to that stage again. So if you have two bodies, you're just quick and get it done quicker.
Yeah.
And plus, as a backup, like we mentioned, you're just put at ease that, if something fails, I have a backup in the car or with me.
Cool. Okay, so we've got our you know, dual bodies and our lenses, what other gear are you bringing along?
Reflector, that's always one in the camera bag, one in the car, lying around the houses. That's one of the equipments that you any portrait photographer should have. Depending on what we are shooting, I'll get an off-camera flash. I use the Elenchrom's, which is basically a flash. I still carry a speed light along with me, but it's just quick. You don't need to set it up. So I'll carry a speed light with me and an off-camera flash. I like to shoot tethered, so I always connect to Capture One, shoot it on a MacBook, so the whole team gets to see what we're creating rather than the back of the screen and they're standing over your shoulder. I just keep the laptop there, and it's always pictures are going up there. And the makeup artists can see things that I'm not seeing. They look at things from different perspective. A stylist might look at the outfit and be like, I need to fix that. So it's nicer to have it on a bigger screen rather than just your small screen on your camera. So shooting tethered is what I like doing. It might take a little bit of time for someone else to figure it out on how it does, but it's fairly straightforward. And if you're shooting in a studio or indoors, you should always have it with you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we'll go a bit more in depth on tethering a little bit later in the show. But is there, just to go back to your flash, do you have any sort of go-to modifiers that you kind of always use, or are you sort of changing up your modifiers depending on the shoot?
Depending on the look that we're trying to create, I have a few different modifiers that I like using. I have a 150 centimeter umbrella, which is massive and it's deep. So it gives you that deep shadows, but it's still soft. So, and those are relatively cheap. You can pick one up for about $150, $200 from PhotoCare or any of the online retailers. You can pick up one of those. It's called a deep parabolic umbrella. So it's 150 centimeters wide. So it's giving you that nice soft light. Then I have a beauty dish, which is mainly again used for beauty. Like we spoke in the first episode of clamshell lighting, you can use a beauty dish. That's a little bit cumbersome to carry. It's a metal dish, which is about 60 centimeters wide and about a feet deep. It's a little bit cumbersome to carry. The umbrella folds down nice and easy.
Mm-hmm.
And what else do I have? Octobox, which is octa shape. And yeah, that's again deep, gives you that nice soft light. So you can play with those.
Yeah. If you were to bring one modifier with you to go with your flash?
My Elenchrom Deep Octobox. So it's a deep octa, so you get that beautiful contrasty light, and it's still soft. That works on any person. You can use it multiple ways. So yeah, the Elenchrom Deep Octa would probably be my favorite. A little bit of a hoarder with those. I have three of those. I don't know why, but yeah, I have three of those.
Yeah, nice. No, cool. Everyone tends to have their favorite piece of kit that they just keep going back to.
Cool. You don't need to spend too much money for these. My first one was a beat up one from Topic Rentals. They were getting rid of theirs, which had been rented for its life. And I bought it really cheap. So it doesn't have to be expensive.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like a lot of these pieces of gear that, cost a lot, you know, right off the shelf, like they're great when they are reliable, when you're using them like week after week after week, but you can get them secondhand just to get your foot in the door with experimenting with different types of kit, figuring out what works for you.
Totally.
Renting things is great.
But that's how I started off. Like I said, my Octobox was rented for about 6-7 years at Topic Rentals, every day used by someone. I bought it off secondhand. My first flash, I bought it off Trade Me. The lady didn't want to ship it, so I drove to Hamilton, spent more money on gas rather than the flash. But yeah, you can get it cheaper. You don't have to spend big money, and don't be put off by that I have to spend $3,000 for a flash. You can start off with something bought secondhand, which is just enough to start you off and learn, and then you can invest into your business. But when you're learning, make mistakes. Yeah, learn from that.
Yeah, cool. All right, man. Well, as we've gone through quite a few of the expensive bits of kit, but is there anything else in your case or in your bag that's all those little less expensive either consumables or other little bits and pieces, little clamps or little things that you sort of take to every shoot?
The clamps are super handy. I usually buy them from Bunnings. They always seem to be on a sale on them for some reason. So you could pick up clamps, and they come in super handy. Have a multi-tool. You never know who's going to want one of those. You always need it. Piece of gear is stuck. Your filter is stuck on your lens. You need to take it off. Have a multi-tool with you. The stylist needs something. Have one of those. What else are those quick bits?
Tape, I find. Yeah.
Gaffer tape. Yeah, can't go without gaffer tape.
Yeah. I just find like that one? There's so many different uses you can use gaffer tape for. Like that, I just find like on every shoot I do, I use it for like marking where talent goes. I like use it for labeling bits of gear, for taping a bit of a reflector that's, you know, come loose, yeah. Or, you know, like gaff tape you use on every single shoot.
Gaffer tape on my laptop with the names of the crews. I'm really bad at names and I feel bad for it every time. So I just write the names with a piece of gaffer on my laptop. So I remember who's who. Yeah, that's another thing. Remember names. Yeah. But when it's, you're working with 20 people and it's next set of 20 people the next day, you kind of forget the name. So I write it down and it's just me that I forget names really easily. Yeah. So.
Now that's a great tip, actually. I wish I could. I might do the same on a bit of like a business card or something, because I tend to not be as locked down to, because I don't like tether or anything. I'm not usually locked down to like a laptop or something. But I like the idea. I might just like write it on my arm, like you're back in school, like writing a cheat sheet for an exam.
No, it's just nice to address people by their name. I feel rather than be like, do that.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely a great way to keep connected with people and make sure everyone's
working. The other one would be the dust blower. It comes in so handy all the time. Mm. Dust on your laptop screen, dust on your camera, dust on the garments or stuff like that.
Yeah.
Lint roller comes in really handy, so that's always in the case somewhere.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's the sort of thing that like stylists would usually bring a lint roller, but if you're bringing one too, you're not relying on...
It's just one of those things that that it's in the back of your head that you need to have one, and I just put it in a crate that I bought from Bunnings and just chuck everything into it, and you just carry it around or leave it in the back of your car, so you know you have it handy. So
but fantastic. Cool. Okay, so we've got all our gear patched in the car, we've gone to our location that we found. What's some of the things you make sure you do when you're on set, you know, when you're briefing
I'll take one step back from that real quickly. Make sure you check your gear and your batteries are charged the night before.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure everything is back in the camera where it's supposed to be. I'm really pedantic. When my camera's batteries are charging, I leave the cameras out, so I know there's no battery in it. I don't put it back in the case. So make sure your memory cards are formatted, you have spares of those, your batteries are charged, it's back in there. Carry a phone charger. Someone on set is always going to need a portable phone charger, so make sure you have that. And check your gear. Make sure you've set it right. You're shooting night one day and you're... ISO speed is set to something else.
It's super high and your white balance is all off and
So what I like to do is custom functions on your camera, just set one to your studio. So set it at a base speed. So I set it at F8, 1/60th of a second, ISO 100, eye detect on the new mirrorless cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Save it to custom function one. Get on set, press custom function one. You know all your settings are right there. So make sure you do that. It's just easy, and anything from a 7D, which was like 8 years ago, will have that custom function.
Mm.
So there's no reason for not using it. Just save like a street style profile, a studio profile, just save it to your camera. That just saves time.
That's a really great tip. I kind of wish I had that on my cinema cameras. Like, because there's things like that which come up, like I'm using the C200 now to record this interview. And I have certain settings built in for like how the audio is recorded and things like that. And I have to change that if I'm shooting a wedding or if I'm doing a documentary style. Like I do have to. So there's a bit of things I have to like go through a little list to make sure. Yeah, is the audio set right? Is the autofocus set right?
That's a tip. Like just make sure everything is working. Everything is clean and ready to go for the next morning.
Yeah.
Prepare that the night before. Maybe fire off a quick email. We are meeting at 8:30, so-and-so car park. Here's my phone number. You can't find it. Just call me up. Send an email so everybody's on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And so do you have a checklist when you're saying you're making sure you've got all your gear? Like, do you have a physical checklist that you make sure you tick off? Or is it just kind of placing cameras out, make sure you've got all the batteries?
You could call me old school, but I like to write it down. When I'm planning a shoot, I like to write it down physically, and this is what I'm going to carry.
Yeah,
and I feel once I write it down, I don't forget it, and it's always there right in front of me. You save it on an iPad; it's locked away somewhere. The screen's off; you don't see it. But this is on your desk, and it's hard to forget it. So I tend to write it down, like just on a piece of paper or a notepad, leave it on the desk, so it's in the back of my head. And if I remember something, I'll just jot it down. So I often make lists on what I need to carry, and it's just sometimes those little things that are reflector holders, extra clamp, tend to forget. But if you write it down, it's hard to forget. So I tend to write it down.
Yeah, and when you start to do the same jobs over and over again, like the same types of jobs, it's a really good thing to have those just lists of gear locked in. Like, for example, for my weddings, I've got my gear list for my weddings on like a laminated piece of paper, so I can actually use like a little whiteboard marker and like tick it off like every single every single time. So even when I'm like breaking all my kit down and changing for different types of jobs, when I have a wedding with lots of different kit, I can just go through and pull out the gear list and tick it all off and not have to think
that's
as much.
Always handy. So in my belly case, everything goes where it's supposed to be. So quick look at it, I know that's missing. So you develop that, like you said, your piece of kit, you develop it and it evolves with time. And that's probably one of the reasons I haven't laminated mine, because it just changes so much depending on the job. So I just tend to write it down and then I remember that way. It's just whatever works for you. A picture works for you. Some people like to write it down. Some people just go with their head. So
Totally. Cool, man. Okay, so on set, we're getting on set now, and all the team is arriving. You know, makeup artist, talent, anyone else who's on set. What are your sort of protocols as someone who's the captain of the ship, the person who's running the shoot?
So like I said before, you're playing host pretty much, and think of it that they all come to your house. So introduce each other. This is Ben. He's going to be a videographer for today. This is the talent. She's going to be doing this. Makeup artist, hairstylist. Make sure you introduce all of them. Remind them that this is a set. There's cables all around. Light stands around. Just be careful where to go and what they're doing. Tell them where the water and your kitchen is. Tell them where the toilets are, Wi-Fi, stuff like that, just so they're all on the same page. Make sure everything is, like, loose cables are gaffer taped, because you're in charge for safety pretty much by yourself. And yeah, just make sure everyone's safe and having a good time, basically. So introduce each other, remind them where the fire exit is, where the toilets are, Wi-Fi password, stuff like that. Yeah.
Cool. And is there any kind of on-set etiquette throughout the day when you're shooting that you tend to try and keep to, in terms of like how you're communicating with different contractors and things like that, like how you keep the shoot running smooth?
One of the most important things, just be respectful of each other. Everyone is doing their best. Everyone's trying to get the same goal. So just be respectful on the way you address them. Little things, don't start snapping at people. You're all there to create something, and you're spending about 4 hours or 8 hours all together in one room in a studio. Just be nice to each other, respectful. You're not curing a big disease or something. You're just trying to create photos. So just be calm, and the way you behave on set, everyone else is going to behave. So you're nice and calm, everybody else is nice and calm. You start ranting and grumbling at people, that's how everybody else is going to feel. So I think you just need to remain calm, and everybody knows what they're doing, so just nudge them along if things are starting to fall behind. Just keep them in place. Again, be respectful on the way you do it.
Totally. No, that's the thing, because you're all there to, you know, for the same goal, is to create something awesome. And as the photographer, you are the leader of that little crew, and it is your role to keep everyone happy and on the same path, and you are there to guide the ship, and in terms of
pretty much. If things are taking time, don't start going on that tangent where you're blaming someone. See how you can solve it. Quite often photographers are just solving problems. You're not, that's clicking a button is the least amount of time that you're going to be spending. You're pretty much solving problems and getting stuff done. So don't start. If things are falling behind, try and see where you can recover some time, what you can shoot quickly to recover some time out of it. So everybody's trying to do their best, so just be mindful of that.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So we've got our shoot all set up. We're guiding the ship of terms of our crew, got all our teammates and our talent all on the same goal. We're having a great time and taking some great photos. I want to talk a little bit now about the idea of tethering. Because for someone who hasn't done it before, they might see it as like slowing them down, or they don't like the idea of having the big cable going to a laptop. That's like, what's the point of that? So as someone who probably uses tethering a lot, would you mind giving us some of the pros and cons?
I was on the fence going into it. Like, it's going to slow me down. There's one other thing to worry about, the laptop to worry about, the cable. But it just changed the way we shoot, because think of it this way. You have six people on there. They all are trying to achieve what you're trying to achieve, but they can't see it. It's all, you're holding it, it's showing up on that small screen. You look at it, continue shooting. There's often things that a stylist would notice, a makeup artist would notice. So what I try to do is shoot it on a laptop, have a big screen if I'm in the studio, if I'm on location, just on the laptop. It's still a 15-inch screen is enough to look at it. But in the studio, I have a 27-inch monitor where everybody can see it. That gives you a little bit of distance from the team, gives you time to think what you're doing. They can look at the images. A hairstylist might pick up something that me and the makeup artist have missed, fix that. So you're spending less time later on fixing that error. Images can come up straight away. So you can tether with Lightroom, Capture One, the software that comes with free with your Canon, the CD that comes with it, or the download that comes with it now. And that lets you click the picture and it goes onto the laptop. Everybody can see it. It's a good way to back up your images as well, because you're shooting to the card and to the camera, so you always have two backups. With Capture One, just be mindful, your camera doesn't save the images, it's all on the laptop. Lightroom does both, so that's one of the advantages. I find Lightroom quite slow while tethering. Capture One works faster. You can use the Canon software that's doing both. It records to your SD card and the laptop. So
yeah.
That's a good way to back up images while you're doing, while you're on the shoot as well. So
yeah.
That's one of the advantages. So you can do it with a USB cable that comes with your camera quite often. It'll be 1.5 meters or 2 meters long. You can buy longer ones. I tend to use Tether Tools ones. It's orange in color. You might have seen it on various different sets. A little bit pricey, but they work really well. I have tried with cheaper cables before. It's just not the same. Connection drops out quite often. Good enough if you're shooting 10 or 20 portraits a day, but when you're doing this all day long, all week long, you kind of want something that's reliable. Tether Tools or any other brand would work well.
Yeah, totally. And Capture One is a software that you'd probably say most working professionals use.
Most commercial advertising photographers use it. It's it's quicker. Lightroom is just, I feel it's just dated the way it's designed. Even a newer computer will feel sluggish on it. So yeah, I think it doesn't use all the cores that your computer has, basically. So it probably needs to rewrite the whole software, make it what it is. But yeah, it started off like as a catalog, but now it's turned into a whole editing software, Lightroom. But yeah, Capture One was designed with photographers in mind.
Yeah,
and they roughly cost the same. So it's not even, it used to be really expensive to buy Capture One, but now they're almost the same subscription model to pay for it. So yeah.
No, cool. Yeah, no, it's just good for people to just be aware just in terms of how they're choosing their softwares when they go in, what are the pros and cons.
If you don't have the budget for it, just use the Canon software that comes with your camera. That lets you do the same. You can control your camera, change the white balance, change the aperture, shutter speed, everything from your laptop. And that basically is free.
Totally. I guess I want to go a little bit more into software now as we sort of round out this show, and just talk about post-production. So we've got all our images now, and what are some of your, so what's your sort of go-to workflow in terms of managing those images? Are you the person who's culling and editing and retouching potentially? What's your sort of workflow?
So first things first, when you finish your shoot, make sure you back it up. I'm a big advocate for backing up your images at least 2 to 3 places. When I'm in the studio, it's connected to a NAS. Everything is going to a big hard drive, storing everything there. If you don't have a setup like that, back it up maybe to a USB hard disk or something. 2 or 3 places at least, have one on you. So even if something gets stolen or your laptop stops for some reason or you break it, you have an image. Because you're shooting for a client, they have that expectation that you know what you're doing, even if you don't. So yeah, make sure you back up everything. That's probably the first thing. Yeah, once I'm home, look through the images, back it up once again if I'm on my home computer. I cull the images, eyes are shut, slightly blurry, delete all those images. That's one of the advantages of using the mirrorless now. It's eye detect, so your focus is pretty much spot on every single time. And yeah, I've noticed that moving from the 5DS to the R5, the eye detect, I'm getting many more hits, especially when shooting outdoors. It just makes my life easier. I'm still getting used to the electronic viewfinder, but yeah, I'm sure I'll get there. So start cutting through the images. If the client has a budget, I'll get a retoucher to do the images. If not, I'm doing them myself. I'm not too heavy on grading the files. I try and adapt to what the customer needs. My work is more mainly commercial, so I'm trying to match what has already been done for them, so the images don't stand out too much on the website. Editorial, depending on what the mood is, what the editor has in mind for this issue, you're trying to play that. So yeah, when it comes to commercial and advertising, you're trying to adapt to what the customer wants. And it's really hard to say, I only shoot black and white, I only shoot this grade, and blue and orange is my only color that I shoot. So yeah, it's hard to do that when you're shooting editorial and commercial, basically.
Yeah. So if you would say to someone who's potentially doing either their first job or even probably more so doing a sort of style or a setup shoot for their portfolio, would you suggest going for a kind of cleaner, more neutral look rather than anything highly stylized in terms of the grade, in terms of the coloring of it in post?
It, with personal shoots, what are you trying to get out of it? Mm. Are you trying to get work from a particular type of client, so you try and adapt to that and that's where you're focusing? Personal shoots, go crazy, I would say. Do what you like doing. That's the only way you can show off your creativity, because working commercial, working to a brief, you're always delivering what the customer wants and following a brief, following a checklist. So with your personal shoots, go as crazy as possible. No two pictures have to look the same. You can do what you like. And yeah, that's mainly where your creative output is. Like, yeah, for your personal shoots, go crazy.
Mm. And with your post-production and grading and stuff, are you doing that in Lightroom? Are you doing Photoshop? What's your sort of software?
Capture One and Photoshop. So yeah, Capture One is where I'll get all my colors right, get the grading where I want it to be, and then Photoshop if I have to remove some objects or stuff like that. I'm not too big on changing body types. That's just something I don't do. So that's a whole different topic. Lost a few jobs because of that, but yeah, that's a whole different topic. I just don't get into altering body types or stuff like that.
That's definitely a an area of ethics that comes in when you start to work in
I've lost a few jobs for it. I just say upfront that's something I don't do, and you can go to someone else. I'll recommend someone, but that's just something I don't do.
Why don't you just take, I'd love to take a moment to broach that topic, because it's something that is probably important for people to keep in mind when they're starting off their career, or sort of, you know, starting their first step into a career in especially commercial photography. Can you talk a little bit about ethics and I guess your own sort of morality as a creative going forward? Like, how is it important for you to sort of stick to your guns? And because some people might see that as a bit scary in terms of turning away work, but you know, having strong ethics in your career as a creative is really important. So do you mind talking a little bit to that? And
That's a good thing that we're speaking about this while we were on a tangent of a whole different topic that we're speaking to. But yeah, I think the standards were set differently for what beauty should look like and what a beautiful person looks like, particular type of eyes, particular type of skin color, stuff like that. So yeah, I think everyone is beautiful in their own way, and that's why portraiture, like, everyone has a story. So that's how I got into portraiture. And yeah, I wouldn't want to change something else when I hired the person, hired the model for their look, and then change it in post. It just doesn't make sense. Like, you look at some people, different skin tone, and in their pictures they look bronze or some other color. I know it's beauty, you're trying to create something else, but that's just not what I do. And it comes up to you on what your ethical stance are and how much you can edit a body type or skin color and stuff like that. So if it's an acne, all for it, take it off, because that's going to go away in a week. If it's a mole that the person has, leave it there. That's who they are, that's beauty to them. So don't create this false standard that everybody has flawless skin. Acne is fine. Like, it's there for a week, it goes away. So
Cool. Then that was just nice to just quickly touch on that, because it's an area that because ethics covers all sorts of things, but it's an area that kind of only really comes up when you start to do work for other people, and you're starting to sort of have someone say, you know, I want to pay you X amount of dollars to do this for me, and I want you to do X, Y, Z. And when someone's paying you to do the thing, you're like, okay, sure, I'll do it, because I'm getting paid to do it, so I'll do it. But
it is hard, especially when you're starting off. It's your first $2,000 job where you're getting this, and you're like, I don't want to edit the person and make them look something they're not. But it is tempting, but that comes up to you. Like, and it definitely pays off. Like, I won't even say it pays off, I just feel nice about it, that I didn't edit someone's image and make them look completely different to what they are in real life. Not even about the money, but just guilt conscience, basically, that I didn't do it.
I guess just...
And I think it's going to take multiple photographers like me and you to understand that and change the industry. But yeah, that's the false standard we were set to believe.
Yeah, but I guess I just wanted to reassure people going into the beginning of their career that if you turn down a job because you feel uncomfortable about it, more work will come. You know, but like,
that's the thing. That's the one thing I would like to add to this. You need to learn to say no.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. And you're going to get used to listening to no as well. Not every job that you quote for, you're going to get. So yeah, learn to accept no as an answer.
Yeah. And learn to say no.
Learn to say no. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. 100%. It's something that you, I mean, different people take times to learn it over their career, but it's definitely a turning point in your creative career when you learn that you can say no and that's not the end of your...
I've done jobs like half the price or one third the price of what I would charge, but it made me feel good. I was creating something for a brand or a person that actually believed in a similar ideology. Yeah, so don't be afraid. Yeah, it's just money. You can make more of it.
Exactly. Cool, man. That was a great little tangent. And now to finish off the show today, I want to kind of take a break from everything we sort of talked about so far and just talk about one thing that I saw pop up on social sort of a few months ago. And that's that you started where you got your a Hasselblad and you just. You've been shooting on film. So you want to talk a little bit about your experience with shooting on film in the world of digital and sort of how that relates to your commercial digital work.
I always wanted a Hasselblad. I think one of the first books, I didn't really read books till I was like 21, 22. I just didn't. I was out working on my motorbikes and going out and stuff like that. So I really didn't read books or didn't get into photography back then. But yeah, then one of the first books I picked up was the Hasselblad Victor series. So they make a book every year of their photographers. And it's this beautiful A3 book where it's just pictures of photographers who use Hasselblads. And yeah, that was beautiful black and white portraits. I think Tupac was in it. That's maybe why I picked it up. And yeah, there was this beautiful landscape photos and all of it. And since then, I always wanted one. And 10 years looking for one, I'm like, just can't afford it. Max, a friend of mine, he decided to sell his, and that's when I picked it up. And yeah, it shoots 120 film, slows you really down. Like, there's no eye focus, no autofocus in that. So it almost feels like driving a tractor when compared to an R5, which is like a Tesla of cameras. So it slows you right down. It makes you think a lot more. Your composition is square because you're shooting a 6x6. And so you're always square. So everything that you've worked on for so long, rule of thirds and everything, that's all just changes, like you're shooting square and that's it. And some of the first like 5 or 6 rolls, I just took pictures of my friends, and there's some of my favorite photos that I've done so far. It's just something about the quality. It's about 60-70 years old now, and that just slows you down, makes you enjoy things a lot more.
I would love to hear the that relationship between the R5, which is like you're saying, like a Tesla of cameras versus
pretty much drives itself. Eye focus. Yeah, you can just sit there and not even look at the camera and take beautiful pictures.
And when you take something like the analog process, and especially something like a medium format camera like that, that really changes you around. You know, you're using that.
It pretty much brings you down to square one. I had to learn how to expose correctly. Because you're exposing for the shadows on film, not saving your highlights like you do on digital. So it strips you right back. You start off from fresh. And that translates so well, even when I'm shooting with my R5. Now I slow it right down, enjoy and see what I'm doing a little more rather than just going 20 frames a second. One of them would be good. And that translates straight into digital as well, where you're a little more mindful of what you're shooting, setting up correctly and then shooting it. And with analog, it's nothing to fix in post. Like, you get what you get. So if you mess up your exposure, there's only so much latitude with film that you can't get it back to where you want it to be. But on a digital, I think it makes you lazy.
Yeah. No, it's cool because it's like digital's fantastic to learn because there's no...
It is. And again, I'm not saying you have to have an R5 or something like that. Like, I think this is the second camera or the third camera I bought brand new. All my cameras have been secondhand before this.
Yeah.
I still have a 5D Mark II. I just love the colors that you get with a 5D Mark II on the skin tones. Pick up one. You can buy one for like $500, a 50mm lens, still get beautiful images.
Yeah.
I think people need to stop fantasizing the high-end gear. And there's one every year that comes out. I remember when I had the 5D2, 4 years, 5D3 comes out, 5D4. But now there's like so many new cameras in the market. So I think just slow down and enjoy the whole process. Learn more about light and how you want to capture a portrait. yeah, you don't have to have all the fanciest gear. I still, when I'm shooting personally, I'll still pick up the 5D2.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's kind of my whole point with bringing up this idea of film with you is it's because it's something that a lot of pros go back to with like sort of years on in their career. They sort of suddenly like rediscover analog again.
Yeah.
And it just takes you straight back to basics and yeah, that just
reimagines
your.
Well.
Yeah, I just picked up a
Canon 1N as well, just to have a 35. Yeah. It's the same body as the 1D that I used to have, and it's exactly the same body, and it's much more enjoyable. So yeah, and it brings back the thing that you picked up the camera to begin with to have fun with it. It wasn't meant to be a job. Like that's how I think all of us get into it. We just love creating images, and that's what it takes you back to with film. Yeah, I'm not saying you have to go back to film. Just enjoy it and be mindful of what you're shooting.
Yeah, totally. It's you're right. It's not about film, it's about just slowing down.
That's just a medium that slows us down. Yeah, that's just a medium to slow us down, but you can do that with digital. You don't have to have a film camera. Just pick up your camera and go out and shoot. Say, I'm only going to shoot 35 today in manual and only going to shoot at shutter speed 1/60th. Put some challenges. That keeps you motivated.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you don't have to buy a digital camera, a film camera, just go out with your digital and treat it like it was a film camera. So
Give yourself 32 frames to shoot
36, just stick to that. Yeah, that's what we did. Like a couple of weeks ago, me and a couple of my friends just caught up at the viaduct, went away for 30 minutes, come back and just show us your 20 images that you got, no more than 20 images. So
totally, it's good to just get that recheck, that reset, because
why you started and why you enjoyed it to begin with.
Exactly. Cool. Well, I think that's a fantastic place to stop this episode. And next week, we are going to be ramping up the school level once again. And we're going to be speaking to basically your peers, really. So next week episode is going to be about the working professional. So we're going to be really diving into all your learnings that you've had throughout your career, kind of more of the businessy side of things. How do you really understand the client, know what they're after, things like that. So that's what we're going to be talking about next week. I hope you enjoyed the show and are enjoying the series so far. Anu, thanks for joining us, and
we'll see you next week.
It
was really insightful here. We went off on a tangent about film and ethics, but yeah, that was really good.
Cool, man. All right. Sweet as. We'll see you guys next week. Bye.